Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our Chapel Hill neighbor, Dan Patterson, is the Keenan Professor Emeritus of English and is the former chair of the curriculum in folklore. Have I got that right, Dr. Patterson?
Exactly, right. Except it's no longer existent.
It's now merged into American studies. But you had a very unusual hobby. I mean, appropriate for Halloween, maybe, but you got interested in gravestones in North Carolina. How did? And well, just to prepare people, that little hobby turned into a passion, and the passion has turned into a magnificent book published by UNC Press, which is about more than gravestones. But what got you interested in gravestones?
Well, it's an odd kind of connection, but I went off to New England working on a book on Shaker songs. And that was back in the late 60s and early 70s. And every time I drove around in New England up there in the summer times, I'd come in a little village, and here would be a great white church at one end and around the town common and stores around it. But back around the back of the church and on the sides would be those white marble and old dark slate grave markers and red sandstone grave markers. And I would go and take a look at them. They were curious looking, really interesting. And people in that period, in the 1970s, people studying material culture, were getting fascinated by those stones and writing books about them. They'd been written about since the 1920s, but in that period, the 1970s and 80s, a lot of new books were coming out that were exploring those. And
a gravestone's a gravestone.
No, they're not. They're cultural documents. and that's what they were beginning to explore, the iconography of why did Puritans who iconoclasts carve all these pictures on their stones. And I got curious about it. I'd never seen anything like that done in North Carolina. I grew up here, and I was about 30 years old then, and had never seen anything that was at all resembled what I saw up there in New England. So I began, when I got back, just to wander out on a Saturday and drive around and stop at a little country church or see what I could find. And pretty soon saw that it wasn't going to be in the Baptist churches. They weren't old enough. Weren't going to be in Methodist churches. They weren't old enough. It had to be Presbyterian or Lutheran or Evangelical, Reform, German, or
what
early
were you
Scotch
looking?
Irish.
I mean, what were you? What was it that was on gravestones you were looking for that weren't on the later or the more modern gravestones?
The more modern ones are kind of national culture, and they're machine products. And I was wanting to see the things that were handmade and the things that were that represented a local tradition, if I could find something like that.
So the gravestones that we see now are likely to be common throughout the country. They're flat. I don't want to say perfect, but the letters are and the designs
are conventionalized, and they probably get them out of templates or pattern books and. And they do change across time, but they're not very interesting, not very personalized.
The other thing, I'm just trying to think of the Chapel Hill graveyard, that the stones seem, by and large, to be fairly simple, with letters of the born such and such, died such, name.
That's right, because they charge by the letter. And so most people don't have money enough to pay for a lot of letters on these. But in a lot of the older ones, even 19th century ones, there'll be extensive verse or prose inscriptions, and those tell a lot. It's more than just a name and a death of date of death and an age. The older stones tell much more, and the pictures are much more traditionally based in old folk traditions, if you get back early enough.
So where did you find what you thought you were looking for?
Well, I thought, I began to, occasionally you'd go to a church, even around here, and find something that's handmade and is very old, 18th century. I realized it had to be back pretty much before about 1800.
I'm still hadn't understood. Why did it have to be earlier? Why did it have to be back
because
so early?
Because that's when you had less standardization. And so it was much more,
so
each stone
about,
was more
about, help me with this. This is a question. I'm walking on thin ice talking to the professor about it. But about 1800 or a little bit after that, then these gray stones across the country started being more standardized and less works of
individual
local art.
Local carving. They came from Petersburg, Virginia, or they came from Columbia, South Carolina in the later period, or Charleston early. And it differed, of course, where you were in the state. In the eastern part of the state, they didn't have stone. It had sandy soil. And so you didn't find a local carving developing as much in the east. You had fancy stones occasionally, early stones that were really interesting, but they came from New England. They were bought.
They're bought and transported down. And
that's right.
So that would be expensive in itself.
Yeah, and the carver might come down with blanks on which they'd already carved the designs at the top of the stone, the winged face or winged skull or something else. That was the dominant motif in New England. And you can even identify which particular place in New England a stone down here came from, because a lot of work has been done on those New England stones. They had... Up there, they had a tradition that went back into the 17th century. And, of course, we weren't settled much down here that early, until the end of the century. And, in fact, in the central part of North Carolina, where there is stone and was stone to carve, the settlement didn't come until the middle of the century. And so the period of development down here was about 50 years.
Which were from what years?
From say 1750 or 60 up to 1800, 1810. And in New England, you'd had 150 years of it. So up there, the tradition is much richer than it is down here in North Carolina, because it was foreshortened so much. And I would drive around, I'd see here and there an interesting stone, but there'd be maybe one or two stones clearly from one hand that's made by man for his own family. It might not, sometimes it wasn't even shaped, just a shaped, it was just a jagged piece of slate that had a flat surface on two sides, and the rest of it you didn't even try to shape. In Buffalo Presbyterian Church in Greensboro, for example, there are two stones from one hand, and the lettering is not really lettered, it's scratched onto the stone by in handwriting. They're interesting stones.
So they went out in the backyard and got a stone, or they were
just found something somewhere and that they could use because they wanted to memorialize their family members
and didn't have the money to go fancy.
There was nobody to buy it from. This was the first generation of settlers, so the they didn't come in with that skill very often. They came in as
so. This was really what you saw or what you were seeing there were really homemade, from non-experts who just happened to have the ability to get a stone and put it over the grave of a loved one and write something on it.
It could be something very powerful and moving. One of those in Greensboro said, "In love we lived, in love she died. Life was required, but God denied."
Oh, well.
And it really strikes your heart.
It's in that
statement. It's a homemade verse, too. It's in.
That's not quoted from some a poem somewhere that's published.
No, that's in accentual verse, which is the old folk verse of ballad. It's not quite in the ballad stanza, but it belongs to that same tradition of verse that it's not rhymed and metered as we do now, or as Frost or someone like that.
Now, I'm fascinated, and I'm going to get off topic, but this is not what you were looking for. Is that right?
Well, I was looking for it, except there's not enough of it. Nothing you can build out of one or two stones, you know. And that's what you found in most of the Piedmont. Just a little pocket here or there, where one person did five stones here, or 11 in all, between two churches, and it just doesn't add up to much.
As best you can tell, in these church graveyards, the graves during this period were being marked from the very beginning, marked with something. Is that
right? A lot
of
times it's lumps of field stone, the unshaped, completely unshaped. They just put a stone on the grave so they could remember just where it was. And then we know, too, that they often made them of wood which they could do themselves much more easily. Anybody could get a piece of wood and flatten it and carve names and so on in it. But those don't most of the time last. Mm-hmm. There are a few done in Charleston, probably 18th century markers made of cypress or some wood that would endure. There are a few in Harnett County I saw that were wooden markers placed about 1925. Sometimes they had a plastic cover and words written on a piece of paper stuck behind the plastic cover, which preserved the statement of who it was, and they were dated about 1925. So some of them have survived, maybe back to there,
but not forever with their
not
wood.
Forever.
And, now you're rummaging around, and how did you come to decide what you found? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I just kept wandering around. I mean, I didn't do it seriously. I was just doing it out of curiosity, just wondering if we had anything like that down here. And I was about to wind down. I just hadn't found enough to have a focus or to offer very much. When I went to Theatara Presbyterian Church in
Rowan County. How do you say that? I'm really sorry. I always said Thigh Tower, but
it may be that
I'm not either. But I mean, this. But this is an old church.
It's one of the oldest in that part.
And I interrupted you because I heard that the name of that church.
You grew up much, much closer, and so your pronunciation is
probably correct.
No,
I don't think so. But I was trying to think if that was the place my mother, I think, visited that graveyard. And she told us at some point there were pirates buried in one of these graveyards. Yeah. I'm not sure it was Thigh Tower or whatever, however you say it.
The reason why people thought that was because of there are three footstones in that graveyard that have gotten separated from the headstones because there are no names on the footstones. And each of those three footstones is carved with a skull and crossbones or just a crossbones. And people forgot what that tradition was about. Not pirate tradition or poison bottle. It was a tradition of more an emblem of mortality.
So it was the pirate connotations developed later, and just wish my mother were
tale.
Here.
This is a folk tale. And they got circulated. Our pirates came there, and they were buried there, or executed and buried. Well, the different versions of it, even the pamphlet put out by the church, will differ across time as something else is put in, or it's recorded by Lingle, who was one of the early pastors there. When he was a student at Davidson, I believe, he wrote
a pamphlet about this.
And he put in one version of the tale, and others have put in others. But it's all based on the fact that the tradition in which the carver worked had been forgotten.
Yes. And so
they made up a story that
these folks' ancestors would have understood mean, but it was not
That's right.
Tradition that was preserved.
It's not even a strong tradition down here. In New England, it's the dominant one, the emblem of mortality. It began with skull and crossbones, winged skull, which then transmogrified across a period of 100 years into a winged, smiling face. And that suggested, to historians looking at these things, that there was a change in the religious sensibility of New Englanders across that century, and they were less Calvinistic, less focused on death, less within that kind of late medieval, early, the Renaissance concern with mortality, and more hopeful.
Well, I've gotten
little of that was down here, very little of it.
I've gotten you off track because of my interest in this particular church and its graveyard. As I said, I wish my mother were here to have you clear this mystery up for her. But we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about what, I don't want to say it this way, but sort of what you were really looking for and where you found it. I'm visiting with Dan Patterson, our neighbor, about his new book, The True Image, Gravestone Art and Culture of Scotch-Irish Settlers in Pennsylvania and Carolina Backcountry. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is our neighbor, now our Carolina Meadows neighbor, Dan Patterson. And we're talking about his brand new book. It's called The True Image, and with a subtitle which explains, I guess, what we're talking about, Gravestone Art and the Culture of Scotch-Irish Settlers in the Pennsylvania and Carolina Backcountry. Dan, thanks again for coming. We've been talking about your kind of sort of roaming around what was the Carolina backcountry during the time these gravestones you were focusing in on were developed. I'm not sure I've gotten you to the point where we've really found, whether in your rummaging around, we've gotten to the moment where you said, I found this, and this is what I'm going to concentrate on.
Well, there I was in Rowan County in an old churchyard that slopes down the hill from the church and the backside, and I walked in, and suddenly the stones here were very different from what I saw in, say, Buffalo Presbyterian Church in Greensboro here. There were many old stones, and there were stones of a workmanship that was much superior. It was clearly a trained hand, somebody who had become a master of that craft of stone carving, whereas in the other places it was an amateur.
Designs on the gravestone
The shaping of the stone, the emblems carved at the top, the lettering was much better.
Let's start with shaping. Okay. Shaping, we have an idea of a gravestone generally as just being a rectangle, maybe with an arc at the top, but it's regular. And is this what it developed? Is this what you were looking for?
This is what I was looking for, in part. The stone has good proportions, and these showed one style or school of carving that had a kind of rounded tympanum at the top with rounded shoulders on each side. And then the flat front surface on the rear of these, often it was an unshaped rear. It was just kind of hacked off a little bit.
They would leave the back of it unfinished.
Unfinished in the earliest stones there.
Oh, okay. But in these that you concentrated on?
And even among these, in the earliest ones from the 1760s and 1770s, the rear was unfinished. But after about 1781 or 2, stones produced after that date had two smooth surfaces, and the rear would also have emblems or verses carved on it.
We think of machines, but all of this, I guess, was done by hand.
It was done by hand, and some of the largest stones, in fact, the earliest stones in this particular family tradition of the carvers, I was eventually able to discover that the stones came from Mecklenburg County, were made there, probably west of Charlotte, near Steel Creek Presbyterian Church.
And when something like what we think of as a quarry, or were the stones just close to the surface that they could?
I was never able to find where their quarry was. They used soapstone. In New England, it would have been slate or red sandstone.
I don't know. Soapstone is it granite? Is it?
It's a soft stone of a kind of a gray blue or green blue. Green-gray color, and it's so soft that you could take a nail and scratch the surface of any one of these stones. In fact, many people have taken lawnmowers and scratched the front surface of the stone.
So it made it easy to carve.
And they were, it's a rather inert stone, so it didn't erode the way later white marble stones did.
Would think that a stone that would be easy to carve would be susceptible more to erosion and would disappear.
Well, they are to some degree. I mean, I think the stones differed in quality depending on which particular vein they found of this. I think there must have been a vein probably up on Paul Creek somewhere in Mecklenburg County, because the people owned some property up there who later became the carvers. And it was still in the hands of the family when they stopped carving in about 1815.
All right, so you're in this church and you say, hey, this is
really
what I'm looking at. This is
really
like what I've seen in New England or seen in other...
Some of the same motifs were on them that I saw in New England, but other kinds of things, too, that are very rare in New England, such as coats of arms. You can find stones up there with them, but down here there were a lot of them. That was one of the more dominant motifs on these
stones. Now, you mentioned that in eastern North Carolina, there were a few stones that were imported from New England. Mm-hmm. That would be pretty expensive. Did you suspect at the beginning that these might have been imported stones, or did you know from the very beginning that these were local?
No, I felt from the beginning that these were different. They were not like the ones you saw in New England. The style was different. Mm-hmm. Both of them dipped into the same long tradition of folkloric motifs, but they were different in style of execution, different in what was emphasized in these. And then it was clear that there was also evolution within the tradition here. The stones from the 1780s had additional motifs, patriotic emblems, for example, that were clearly the product of the Revolution. And other things, Masonic emblems, or had emblems that were more personalized, that were not common up there.
What about the religious faith of these? These were Presbyterians.
Their
special way of looking at things make its way into the gravestone?
Yes. The dominant motif, in fact, in the Carolinas, on the stones of this one workshop and on other Scotch-Irish, on the work of other Scotch-Irish, more amateur carvers, and also in Pennsylvania, the dominant motif there in the back country where this particular carving family had come from before they were here, is a dove with a sprig of leaf. Olive branch in its beak. And that occurs over and over again on these stones. It's by far the dominant image, and it's almost as if this is a Scotch-Irish emblem, but it's not there in Ulster, and it's not in Scotland. That motif does appear, but it's in coats of arms there, and not many. It's just one or two, like the Glasgow coat of arms over there in Larne on the coast of Antrim, has that motif. But it's there, a motif from heraldry. But over here it becomes a religious motif. And one person, even down in South Carolina, had one of these carvers carve this image. And the person probably saw the image, said he wanted a dove, and then looked at that and said, that looks like a sparrow. and write, I want you to put the words the dove on there so that people won't think of, misread this emblem. And so the carver carved in, up in the little, up above it a little bit on each side, the dove, as a way to let people know that that's what this person had wanted on the stone. But I think most people understood it immediately. And then it was done that it ran all kinds of variations on it, two doves facing each other, or a tree of life with doves sitting in the tree of life, other kinds of variations of that particular emblem.
Do you have a theory, or do we know what this dove is doing? Here are my theories. First of all, this is symbolic of Noah and the Ark, and the dove comes back with the branch to show that you're in a new neighborhood, which is at. The other is that these Scotch-Irish were not necessarily the most peaceable people in the world. They fought in Northern Ireland, I guess they fought against the native Catholics, and then brought to Pennsylvania and Virginia, where they were on the frontier and fighting the Indians, and then coming down in the Revolution and having to take sides. I mean, they were war. They had an experience of war. So is the dove the symbol of peace, or is it something altogether different?
Well, I think in a spiritual sense, it's peace. It's a promise. It's the dove of promise, that good things will be restored after the troubles. But I think it's you have to read it in that sense, and the thing that probably provoked it was an emphasis on infant damnation.
Oh well, tell me about this.
Well, in the 1770s, they began to read Thomas Paine, The Age of Reason, and he criticized the view that the Calvinists had. That But here were all these children dying, you know, and this then refuted the view of the theological system that God is punishing, you know, and you inherit the punishment, and whether you've died too young ever to have committed a sin, you can still go to hell. You might get the easiest room, as one minister in New England.
So this was this parental affirmation of the value of this child, even
yes.
though dead, and
yes.
this child we declare is going to will be
yes.
united when we die yeah, with this child.
They certainly hoped for it, and you can imagine the minister who didn't preach that was not giving much comfort to a bereaved parent, and most families had infant deaths that they had to suffer through, and some of them had terrible numbers of them, especially during the Revolutionary War, when there was a smallpox epidemic that swept through that whole area. There's one stone there that has the coat of arms of the Campbell family, and then it lists four children on the stone, and they died one day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day in January of 1781. And it's clear that it must have been the smallpox epidemic. In fact, the legend of the church is that the brother went off to war, an older brother went off to war and came back wounded and sick from the militia camp. And then it was discovered that he had smallpox, and his four younger siblings died one day apart. You know, and you can imagine what it would be like in a world where that was happening, and many parents were saying, "But no, you know, but Jesus said, suffer the little children to come unto me," and they even wrote that, and with the "but" on one stone at I think it's Poplar Tent, it says, "But Jesus said," you know.
Oh yes, yes.
As if it's a rebuttal to the minister, some minister that has preached, that you don't know that your child has gone to heaven.
Well. We're visiting with Dan Patterson about his new book, and we'll continue our discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Dan Patterson. We're talking about his new book published by UNC Press. It's called The True Image, Gravestone Art and the Culture of Scotch-Irish Settlers in the Pennsylvania and Carolina Backcountry. And Dr. Patterson, we've had a good time talking about how you got into this. And I'm going to have such a good time talking about how you got into this that we're not going to even talk about the family that you found that were the artists or the carvers whose work I think really is the, I don't want to say it's the nut of your interest in your book, but these are important people. Let's talk about them so we don't get to the end and not have mentioned them. Who are the, is it the Bighams, and where did they come from?
The Bighams had arrived in the states, well, in the colonies, in Pennsylvania, probably around 1735 to 38. In fact, the stones that they carved, or one of them carved there, are the means by which we know that. In Lancaster County at Chestnut Level Presbyterian Church, there are stones, and the earliest of them is dated probably about 1738 from one hand. It's clearly a highly trained hand.
It's not signed, though.
It's not signed.
How do you know who did it?
Because I took down all the names I found on these stones and then went into the archives up there, the county records, and looked up estate records for each of the adult males whose name was on a stone. And on one of them, John Bell, it said in the accounts for the burial and for the settling of the estate, it said a stone, a headstone carved by William Bigham.
Wow. So what you conclude, and it's almost certainly true, is that you concluded these were all done by the same shop or the same artist.
Well, there's a way to prove it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I didn't realize it at first, but as I went from place to place, there are about five places in Pennsylvania where these are found, the stones from this hand. And as it went from stone to stone, you know, I took photographs and I copied off inscriptions. And somewhere along the line, it dawned on me that there was a peculiarity in these things. At the end of the words, aged so many years or so many months, there was a punctuation point, and it was a dot over a triangle. I mean, a dot over a diamond. And at first I thought it was just a semicolon, but then I saw there were also semicolons on the stones at other points, and this is always a dot over a diamond. And I looked at other, there are a few stones that didn't have it, but it was always where the words occurred at the edge of the stone, and it could not have been inscribed, or it had been broken away, because, you know, across time the slate would break. And so that was like a signature mark that he was putting on his stones. And then there was another set of stones up there with a dot over a triangle, which means to me that he was helping somebody else learn, and the other person developed his own variation of the signature mark.
That was his
mark.
Signature yeah. mark.
It was his signature yeah. mark, and he was related enough to the Bighams, that probably a nephew, to get away with it. When they got down here, they taught somebody named James Sloan, and he always put in his earliest stones a dot over a diamond, but the diamond wasn't incised, it was outlined with lines rather than dug into the stone.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a signature mark, and they used that up until about the early 1780s. And so it was things, and down here there's also one Bigham stone in Georgetown, South Carolina, that is signed, engraved in Mecklenburg County in NC, no car, by Samuel Bigham. That's carved on the rear of the stone.
He sent it that far away, he could charge a lot of money for it,
it's advertising.
But
it didn't work. Nobody else there bought one. But it was more beautiful than any of the other stones, and this was a second generation carver. This was the son of the first man.
Well, what do we know about the Bighams?
Well, we know that there were five men named Samuel Bigham in Mecklenburg County in the period when this family was carving there, and there were about five or seven Williams in the county, and there were probably two Hughes or three Hughes who would have been possible, until I found the internet and made contact with some family members, I wasn't able to figure out who these people were. But between my knowledge of where the stones were and when they had been placed there, which gave them information they didn't have about the history of their family, but they also had data from the family that helped us work out the kinships, and it got proved by the Bigham family genealogical DNA project.
Wow!
which verifies that two of the major first generation carvers were probably brothers, they were very close kin, and that the second generation carvers were related to those people. So we were kind of able to
Did the entire family move down to North Carolina from Pennsylvania, or did they leave some?
We don't know. There were at least three different Bigham families in, and that's spelled B-I-G-H-A-M. At least three different Bigham families in Lancaster and York counties, as they were then. It's where they lived in York County is now Adams County, Gettysburg. These stones circle Gettysburg. So there were at least three families of Bighams up there, and we're not sure. One family appears by the genealogical DNA project not to be related to these. The others, a descendant of one of the others has not been found, a male descendant who's in the line. There may be some somewhere, but they haven't been located. But so all the ones from there that came down here were related. And they came down as two brothers. One had a fort that he had built, burned by in the Seven Years' War by a party of French and Indians.
A fort in Pennsylvania or in North Carolina?
Uh-huh. Over in near Honey Grove, Pennsylvania, in Tuscarora Valley. So he fled, and he lost his property to a wealthy man because he apparently had to borrow money when he got out, escaped as a refugee. And he couldn't pay it back, and so he lost the property. And so he moved down to North Carolina. His brother stayed up there for another 7 years, or 9 years, and carved. He came down, the first one, Samuel, came down in 1760. He had, we don't know that he had carved any stone in Pennsylvania, but he worked with his brother probably, at least, with him, and they'd probably tried his hand at it. Got down here, found the soapstone, and he began carving.
Oh, wow.
And he had some gifts for it. And then his brother came down in 1769, and he brought his family, and the first man, the Samuel's grandson, became a carver, and William's two sons, Samuel and William, became carvers, and so they worked as a workshop. It's clear because two names will appear on a single receipt down here.
Wow!
One is the carver, and the other as a witness to the receipt for payment.
If you join us late, we're talking to Dan Patterson about his book. It's on gravestones, and we're going to continue that discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Keenan Professor Emeritus Dan Patterson about his new book, The True Image, Gravestone Art and the Culture of Scotch-Irish Settlers in the Pennsylvania and Carolina Backcountry. When I heard about your book, I said, there's nothing to talk about. You know, gravestones, you can finish that in about a minute and a half, and we're not even close to finishing this. But I am interested in this Bigham family that you've been telling us about. And I want to ask one question, then I want you to kind of wind up our discussion. But was this a full-time occupation for the – could they make a living doing this, or did they have to – or was this sort of part of being farmers or being other things along the way?
What? It's clear they did other things, too. They had to make a living. You had to farm. You'd have to do that even to get the property that you got from the government. You got a patent, and that required you to clear so much land out of the acres that they had per year. So they were doing those things. They also, I think, it's possible that William, who was the first trained carver, came down because his brother learned that he might have customers for building houses. I can't prove that they built houses in Mecklenburg, but there were four stone houses, and they had in this family two first generation carvers who clearly carved, and two sons of the first one who clearly carved, and possible sons of the other one who carved, and the grandson who was a carver, and a neighbor named James Sloan who was a carver, who were there, all of them, in the 1770s. And there were four houses built in Mecklenburg in the 1770s, and these were people. They are available. There are a few other things that would tie them to it, too. But anyway, they might have made their living building houses or doing other stonework for dams and things like that around the county. But they looked into a situation where there were enough people making enough money to become patrons and paying them enough to carve really fine stones that even today have been commented on very favorably by one of the principal men still active in this tradition with an unbroken heritage back to the early 1720s.
Now, who is this and where is he?
This is Nick Benson of the John Stevens shop in Newport, Rhode Island. It's a shop that has an unbroken history since the 1720s.
Not so much in North Carolina, but in this tradition.
This is in New England.
Gotcha.
And he's still doing it the hand way.
So
as a major artist in this country, he's gotten the MacArthur grant for.
My golly, but the Bigham North Carolina family, that's come to an end. There's no...
That's come to an end, but he looked at their stones and said, this is good work.
Well, now, I just have to ask you, we're not going to finish this. People are just going to have to pick up your beautiful book with great pictures, both of the gravestones and the sites and the churches, and a wonderful discussion of the Scotch-Irish in America that supplements the... A wonderful book that the UNC Press published 50 years ago, I guess, The Scotch-Irish. For those of us who have that heritage, this is a great way to dig into it. But now, all of us, we're thinking about what kind of marker we want on our graves. And so after spending 40-some years on this project, are you just going to have... an ordinary marker, or are you going to not have any? You'd have your ashes scattered, but are you going to go and have a gravestone like the Bighams did, go up to New England and have this guy make your gravestone.
It would cost a lot of money.
I know it would, but I mean, but you've got a lot invested in this.
The Mellons have gotten stones for him.
How much? Well, how much?
He's carved for the Kennedy Memorial.
But you got to put your money somewhere. Yeah. This, so you're, instead of, I don't know what a gravestone costs, but probably several thousand dollars maybe would be a high. This is going to be $100,000 to get a gravestone from him.
I don't know. I have no idea what he charges, but
you're not going to go there.
I'm not going to.
You're just going to have a simple gravestone.
See, I couldn't get one locally. I've got to buy one locally. Patronize my neighbors.
Well, I learned the other day that the gravestones that are being sold here, a lot of them come from China. You know that they can pay the cost, the transportation cost to get the lettering and the design done there. Maybe we could get the Chinese to fake a big grave. This is fascinating. Thank you for sharing and pushing this wonderful book and then sharing some of it with us. Our guest has been Professor Dan Patterson, and we've had a good time talking about his book, The True Image, Gravestone Art and the Culture of the Scotch-Irish Settlers in the Pennsylvania and Carolina backcountry. Thank you, Dr. Patterson.
Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. It's been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. I'll be back here before you know it.